So, before we go back into PEX, I'm going to give you a short introduction to code contracts. So in .NET 4.0, there is a new API that allows you to do design by contract. So it allows you to write precondition, postconditions, and invariants. So precondition is what is true when you enter the method, postcondition is what should be true when you leave the method, and also invariant. And it's done in a way that is toolable, so there's a family of tools that can be built on top of that, runtime checker, static checker, documentation, and so forth. So I'm going to show you the basics. Don't try this on your machine because you don't have, unless you have installed, you don't have the code contracts. And in a sense, I'm going to go back to I'm going to go back to this example. So when we fixed the example about the null case, we added a runtime check. The problem with this runtime check is that it stays at runtime, although we know it will not happen. So one way to express precondition in .NET 4.0 is to use a contract type. The contract type lives in system.diagnostic.contracts. It's a new namespace. It allows you to write contracts about methods. If you're familiar with the language Eiffel, it's an implementation of design by contract. Okay, so in a nutshell, you can write requires. So a require is a precondition. So something that should be true when I enter the method. And I'm going to require that mine is not null. Okay. And remove this. Okay, so you can see contracts as an extension of the signature of your method. Not only your method gives you constraints about the types that go in and out, but also now it tells somebody who's calling it, you need to pass me something that is not null. Okay? So
you can see that on the code in completion of IntelliSense.
You will be able to see that in IntelliSense in the future. We're not releasing that component yet, but that's the idea. Those contracts are mineable by a tool. A tool can read them. So yes, we could have a component that shows that in IntelliSense. That's the idea. You get that kind of value. So it's a documentation for somebody who's calling your APIs. But also, it can be turned into an assertion so that at testing, you validate this kind of stuff. Or, which is a more advanced scenario, you can use a static checker to try to validate and prove that your contracts are never violated. But we won't go into those details. So by default, code contracts are conditional. It's like debug assert. They're not turned on unless you want to. So far, it's just a no-op. It's just documentation. Okay, so what I'm going to do is go to my project. Open the properties. You can double-click, actually. There's a new pane here called code contracts. You can go there. And there's a lot of settings, and one of them is to turn on runtime checking. Okay. And also I'm gonna turn this one on just for fun. So contract reference assembly puts all the contract in a separate DLL, which allows us to mine it. That's more an advanced scenario. The interesting scenario for unit testing is to turn all those contracts into assertions, runtime checks. And because they are runtime checks, that means PEX is going to try to break them too. PEX works great with contracts. So let's go back to our, to make it public. And now when I run this with PEX, when PEX is going to generate null is going to trigger a contract violation, so you're going to get a contract exception. But PEX knows about the semantics of contracts, and it's automatically going to flag this contract exception as a negative test case, because we have internal understanding of what contracts are. Okay, so precondition is pretty straightforward. What can you do else with contracts? Where you can write post conditions. So you can write something that should be true when you leave the method. For example, let's say we never want to return null. Okay, so ensures is a post condition, something that is going to be evaluated when you leave the method. And because there's no keyword for the results in C#, we have a special method that encodes that. Okay. So the interesting part is, this is still part of the signature. So you still write all your contracts on top of the method, and then there's a rewriter that removes that post condition at the back of the method. And I will show that in the debugger. Okay, so now that I've said that my method doesn't return null, let's run PEX again. And if you remember the implementation of that method, there's definitely a case where we return null. More than one. Okay, so now you can see that when you validate a post condition, you get a failing test case. Because, well, when you pass the empty array, you return null here. Right? Okay. So just for fun, let's see if I can run a test case so that we can debug debug the post condition and see how it works. So I'm gonna run PEX. So you can see that code contracts and PEX work really well hand in hand. Ultimately, if you don't want code contracts and release bits, they go away. They work great as a documentation. Well, that was the test case that didn't do anything. Let's debug that test case. So I'm going to put a breakpoint here and click on debug. So as you could see, the ensures was on top of the method. Really, we want it to be evaluated when we leave the method. So I'm entering the method, I'm evaluating the precondition, and then I'm going through the method. There's some funny stepping happening. Then, instead of returning immediately, now we evaluate the ensures. And if you look at the variables, doesn't want to show it to me. Fine. So we're going to evaluate that value not null and then leave. So the ensures are automatically moved by a rewriter leaving the method. And then it continues and the execution finishes. So code contracts allows you to, in a very structured way, define what should be true when you enter the method, what should be true when you leave the method. At no performance cost, it works as a documentation, and also, you know, imagine you have a method with many, many exit points, like this one. When you look at this method, it has two exit points, and if you wanted to write an assertion there, you would have to copy and paste it. And now you're gonna actually have a centralized place where anybody can come in and look at the guarantees from your method. Okay, so that's the basic use of code contracts. Now things get really interesting when you deal with interfaces, for example. So let's say we implement the iReader, which has this read value. Okay. Now, as an architect, I'd like to say that we don't return null, ever. So I can do that with contracts. And there are snippets, there are snippets to help you. So you don't have to remember anything. Here it's there's a family of snippets. But basically, the way we can achieve this is by using a body type, because you cannot have method bodies in interfaces. So you have your interface, and then you bind it to a type that contains a contract. So this is binding each other. And now I can write the contracts here in my read-foo value. And we have snippets to say result not null. So it's just a matter of two keystrokes, tap, tap. And the rest of the method doesn't matter. So I've defined a contract for my interface that anybody who implements that interface needs to comply to. And the contract is you should not return null. Okay, so now if I refactor my reader, it's not going to be happy. Let's implement a funny one. Now here I return null. What's going to happen when I try to run pex on this is obviously I didn't read the spec and I'm returning null, which I shouldn't. And if it was an XML comment, nobody would know. But now, since there is this check that checks at runtime that you are not violating the post condition, you're actually going to get an exception. The exception message tells you that you violated the post condition. Right. So this is the post condition that failed. Although, this is what triggered it. Is that all magic, or? Okay, so.
If you do return as you mentioned, then you will pass.
Yeah. It's in this mode where it doesn't want to build anymore. Okay. Broke it. Broke the demo. But yeah, it will pass. So reload the solution, it will pass. So.
But I don't understand is why did you put the not available exception in the
class? Oh, because the body doesn't matter, and you need C sharp to compile it.
Okay.
So you could return null. Do whatever you want. Only the contracts are mined. It's really a workaround. Oh, there we go. Yeah, the add-in is working. Okay, so actually I can see the inherited contract here. So I got this documentation piece. So it's telling me you've inherited some contracts from the interface. And this contract is that you should ensure that the result is not null. You must comply to that. And that was mined from this binaries that contain the contracts. So if I do substring, yeah. So you should see more contracts. But this is one of the tools we're working on to improve the experience. So use contracts in one place, then you get all kinds of benefits. I think documentation was one of the more interesting ones. Now it's in your face what the specification should be. And the specification is extracted from code. That means we also run it in your test. It's not an XML comment that gets outdated immediately.
Okay.
Yes?
In the current 40 version, you can't see that.
No.
Okay.
Daryl Zuniga, our high school intern, has been writing this. When it's stable enough, we'll want to release that. Now it doesn't fail. I'm not sure I want to talk so much about contracts. Anybody ask questions about contracts?
Is it the code about the interface, again, interface?
Yeah. So the trick is you define your interface, and then we have this gluing code. Gluing done through two attributes. And you know, this is really because you cannot have method bodies in interfaces.
Why do you add the attributes in the part of the interface?
These attributes? This one?
Yes.
You need bidirectional binding between the contract and the interface.
Yeah, you can put this in the...
Yeah, so we... You could definitely do this.
Yeah.
But the snippet creates the type automatically.
Okay. So
you could limit that.
Yes.
Ultimately, these things can go away when you compile in retail. The interesting thing is, what I did in my properties. Remember that funny feature here, contract reference assembly. I can actually ship my contract to my customer. So while I ship a highly optimized binary to my customer, which has no checks at runtime, I can actually give him the contracts about all my interfaces, tell me, you look, don't give me null, and I will return you something that is null. And this get mined from the contract assembly. So when you look at the build output of Microsoft contracts, it will give you foo.dll and foo.contracts.dll. Foo.dll may contain only the runtime on your code, and then foo.contracts.dll contain only the contracts. It's just a way to save that. So you can have absolute performance and still give your customers runnable spec of the code, especially people implement your interface. If you're using meth or dependency injection or IOC, it's a great tool to make the story better. And to get this dialogue, you need to go and download code contracts from the DevLabs website. And if you don't have Ultimate, you'll get the runtime checking, and then for static checking, you need a higher version of Visual Studio. Any more questions about contracts? So you can deal with, basically, in general, inheritance in .NET. Abstract method, virtual methods, overloads, and things like that. Maybe some of you are asking the question, why not use attributes? Okay. So it's a common one. So the question is, in a sense, why not have an attribute here to encode that line should be null? And the answer is, there's only so much you can encode in an attribute. Because we cannot put code in it. So, you want something about null, maybe you want the value to be positive, and then maybe you want all the arguments in the array to be not null, and so forth. And at some point, you cannot encode that in an attribute, or you need 57 different versions of the same of the attribute in contrast. So, the team decided to make it an API, just for simplicity. So, you can encode anything. Any Boolean expression as a contract. You're only limited by what your language can express. And you do it with full IntelliSense support and refactoring support.
That's one question. You can write maybe a function call there.
Yes. That function should be pure. Whatever you evaluate in your contracts should not have side effects. Okay, so you could write something like this. And what you need to do is to annotate it with QR. And now you can run this with your little helper. It's also in that namespace. So you can build your own little library of helpers. And actually, if you have already something that looks like a contract in your code base, maybe a validate method or validation class that has all your helpers, there is a read the documentation of code contracts. There is a way for you to annotate that class and then automatically get contracts everywhere. So you don't have to go and retrofit all your code base with every code contract. You need to retrofit the helper class that you use all over the place to validate arguments, if you have one. If you use old-style argument checking, if then throw, it's also supported out of the box. And they're considered as a precondition. And again, there's a big forum about this. This is a DevLabs, so it's an incubation project. Try it out and shoot if you like it or if you don't like it. It works great with pets. And it's in, when you think about this experience about the code digger where you're just playing right there with your code, it really helps because you can express those post conditions. Right? So right there I can maybe, let's say I can refactor this line. So here I could say it wasn't null, and I could also remove the noise about the lines. Maybe I can say that's lines.all. Oh, I don't have system link. Maybe I'm going to say that the lines should be null, so I can say and I can write things that are pretty complicated in those contracts. Pex will understand that, and you won't pay a runtime cost for that, but you will run those checks at test time, and it's also documentation for the next guy coming in that documents whatever assumption you had in your head. Don't always think that there's someone behind you who's not in your head who's going to have to deal with your code. Okay. So that's, in a nutshell, the code contract story.
It's possible to define a condition in the middle of a run. For example, a variable that at the beginning, you're sure that has some kind of value, but the middle of the method can say something.
You can write assertions. So.
But not code contracts.
In fact, yeah, not code. So. Preconditions can only refer to public state because they are documentation. So you cannot refer to private fields or anything like that. Because ultimately, this is internal to documentation. So in that sense, you cannot do preconditions in the middle of the meta. Postcondition can refer to private state. But if you need something like here you could, in the middle, usually you want to assert. Okay, this is wrong.
But if you need to in a loop or something in the body, then you use assert. Ensures and requires only valid at the method boundary.
You can also document exceptions. So you can give, let's say, a condition that is true. So in this case, move that to this guy. So here I'm documenting the fact that this exception might throw a foul and upon exception. It's a funny way to do it, but I'm basically saying that when foul and upon is true, is thrown, the state of the program is still okay.
you can actually recover from it, which is not always the case. When you catch something, how do you know the problem is still in the good state? Or do you have to throw away? So you can state post conditions when you successfully execute, but also when you actually have an exception of that bubble up. And this becomes documentation. There's a pretty good reference manual. There's a pretty active forum that you can go and look at contracts. There's a lot of blog posts about it. I encourage you to download it and play on your own time, but I think if we start downloading it now, we're going to lose a lot of time. So I'm going to move on to more tech stuff, or maybe you want to talk more about good contracts. You can do a vote. You want to move back to pegs, moles, contracts, or moles? Okay,
before we go into moles, let's talk about complex types. Okay, so
here's a variation of our little of a test case that needs a complex type, my own little reader type. Okay. So far we've seen test cases that use strings, array of strings, integers, and so forth. What about your own types? And in this case, we need a reader, but things get complicated when reader is abstract. How do you create an instance of that? When it has no public constructors, or when it has many constructors, which one do you pick? Or in general, it's hard. And think about the list. You have add range, remove, here, remove if. There's an exponential number of combination of method calls you can do to build state. So PEX has a number of heuristics to create objects, but ultimately we're not that smart. We haven't solved that problem. And the way you deal with creating a custom object is through factory methods. So
class.
So basically, in a static class, you can create a static or any number of static methods that can be parameterized and that should instantiate your objects in such a way that you assign the entire state. And what we mean, the entire state is all the fields. And we don't really want to do that with reflection. We would break what kind of invariance you have. So you really want to do that through public method. For example, let's say this reader type has a factory method, let's say, that takes a string. And you basically implement the logic on how to create your object. What will happen is we'll mine that and use that when we need to create the reader type. Quick example. Quick demo. You don't have to go through that. Just see if I build. Okay. So let's see reader. So let's make reader hard to create. Private constructor. And it has a funny up. And here we start the value. So PEX today doesn't understand about this. But now let's do a test case, which takes a reader. And that's exactly what's on the slide. So when we're going to run a PEX with this, it's going to be pretty depressing. It's going to tell you that it couldn't create any instance of the reader type. So this is the typical experience. Show you that.
You get null, which is, we can always create null. And you get this. This should raise your attention. There's an object creation issue. Okay, let me go and click on that. And it tells you, I couldn't guess how to create reader. It's basically a hint that it needs help. So there is this little button here. Can we click? And then it's going to generate all kind of stuff for me. Yeah, in this case, it's going to generate an entire test project, which I didn't expect, but anyways. Okay. And now, okay, we have a new test project. So PEG generated this new test project. And in that test project, it generated a new file here. And in that file, it generated the static method, which you can edit. There's a big to-do here. So we're going to do public. Oh, okay. So I don't. So I need a factory. Okay. I realize my objects are hard to create. Great. And so you need a value here, and then you just add it here. And it can take more arguments. Those arguments can be other objects and so forth. We will create a graph of objects and then and use that. It adds overhead to the search. So if the constructor of a reader executes a lot of code, it puts a lot of burden on the exploration of PEGs. Okay, so now that we have that, we can actually go back to the implementation and test our test reader. And what's going to happen is PEX is going to mine the test assembly for those static methods, and it's going to use that. And that will give him a way to create this reader object. And now it's going to be able to analyze what's happening and generate a test case that that triggers the bug. Hopefully I spelled that right. I don't have the... I know the ASCII word. So that's basically the story about creating objects. What you'll want to do usually is to, for each of those, to actually create a parameterized unit test that tests the factory. Because if the factory fails, PEX will suddenly be unable to generate objects. So you always want to test your factory. But in a nutshell, that's how you create complex objects.
You have to keep the factory as small as possible.
Yes. You pay for every instruction in PEX. Nothing is free. So the closer you are to the code you're testing, the better. If those objects have a lot of logic in the constructor, it will put a lot of burden on the analysis. If your objects are simple data types, it's really easy for PEX. So it's a trade-off. There's no hiding. No, you pay for what you're using. You pay for if you love features that use a lot of performance, you will pay the price for PEX. It will just compute.
If I pay, for instance, instruction in the factory method, I can have more than one factory method with different relations.
You can, yes.
And how PEX decide which constructor?
It will try both.
Both?
Yes.
Always.
It should, yeah. We're not bug-free, but yeah, it should try both.
Yes.
Okay, so that was the story, and...
Okay. You write assumptions in your
yes. So, in factory methods, all exceptions are considered as assumptions.
What I mean by that is any execution path that throws is silently refused by the PEX because we look for an execution path that actually returns something. So you can assume or you can put all the checks in your code. So maybe, for example, here, what I want to do is do that. I require value to be done now. In that case, the case for value is null should disappear because it will silently fail and be filtered out by text. And it didn't disappear. Oh, now we have an integer. So it's reincarnated into something different. Okay. Okay, so let's see. Before we go into this exercise, let's go back to moles because I had a couple more exercises for you guys. So since mole was this morning, you probably forgot everything about it. Okay, so remember the time where we had a unit test? Before we messed it around with Bex, we had a unit test that called real lines. So what we're going to do now is add a check that makes sure the file exists, and we're going to update our test case with moles so that we're C isolated. So that's what you need to do now. And there's one trick you can learn. It's this first line on top. The first line that says mfile.behave has not implemented. It's basically telling the MOLS framework whenever a method on file is called for an exception, unless the user registered a delegate for it, which basically is trapped. So if you're trying to call something like file exists, you haven't set a MOL for it, it will throw an exception. Tell you no. So it's a nice way to ensure isolation in your code. Just tell, I forbid the file type or web request or HTTP contest. And then anywhere in the execution path, when you hit that code, it will throw. So you can't hide from us. Okay, so get back to your projects. Try to recover something that looks like a unit test. And then start here, add this piece of code into your implementation. So if not file exists, return out. Run the test case, you'll see you'll get this final file exception, which is exactly what we don't want to have. And then try adding this end file and get it.
Okay, I'm gonna do it. By the way, you can definitely use PEX as your runner. we'll run non-parameterized methods, or Now, if you're done with the exercise, here's a challenge for you. Assert that read all lines got called with the right file name. So far, we never actually checked we read the correct file name. How would you do that? So how can you observe things that happen in those delegates easily?
So maybe I give you the hint.
One way to do it would be here I'm asserting that I call read all lines with the right file name. The cool thing is I can just use assert, because this is just C sharp. Is it shocking or just plain obvious to everyone? Anybody sees a problem with this? What if I never call read all lines? Then I never run this assertion. Okay, so the other thing you can do is use, and I'll let you think about this one. The message here is there is this thing called closures in C sharp, and it just works. So you can create a local, actually observe side effects in those delegates, and then now you'll see that file name will be changed here. The local is not really local anymore. It's pushed to the heap, but this is just compiler magic. You shouldn't really know about this. But it's fully supported, fully debuggable. So whenever you want to assert that something got called, you can use that. Yeah, you have to do it manually.
Yeah, no, that's something more automatic.
No.
For example, in Rhino,
method?
Yes. So the question is there an API to do that in a more structured way or something like that? And the message is no. And in a sense, already this test case has issues because you're hard coding the protocol of methods in there. And with Moz, we want to promote something that is more towards modeling. So in fact, in future version, we'll start showing how you can write in a different way your test case. But the answer is no, we don't provide this API. And this was a by design choice, which people agree or disagree, but we prefer. It might be more coding, but yeah, you have to hard code it. Ultimately, somebody who comes into the team and knows about Clojure will understand that. But it's arguable. If you're trained with Rhino or MockU, you might be thinking I'm totally crazy. But this was our decision, and also boils down to complexity of the code. This is the most efficient way to encode this in terms of IL instruction being understandable by PEX.
So you don't have anything like an ensure method call and a method?
No.
You don't need to use this code or anything?
Yeah. You can use MockU. Or a Rhino or NMock or...
What about support for PEX when you're using a mocking framework? Like MockU, is there any kind of support?
So MockU has done work to work better with PEX. So it works relatively better, but still it's a big overhead.
But we should have any...
I think you can just try it, and you'll use it. It's really about how many IO instructions you need to execute with other frameworks.
So this is like creating a flag.
Yeah.
You can use a Boolean or whatever.
Yes, whatever. So why is that? In a sense, let's enter the discussion. The problem with this kind of mock-based testing is that your test cases are quite fragile. If you change file readable text by using a stream, for example, or your test case fail, although just your code is still correct. What we would like to see in the future is you refactor all this code into a little model of the file system, and then you code against the model of the file system. So that's pretty abstract, what I'm telling you there. But the idea is you want to refactor this the way you do this. For example, I'm sure I want to go here today. This might take long. Okay. So I'm not going to go there today because I don't have the time. But in the future, we will want to push more models than encoding of protocol of functions. So in that sense, you can say that Moz is more verbose than other framework. That's totally fair. And that's by design. But you can build your own API on top of us and get the same result. You can. Okay, so is everybody on par? Okay, so the next exercise gets more interesting. So far we've seen static methods, which was fairly easy and fun. So what about constructors? Who has an idea about constructors? Okay, what is a constructor anyway? It's a method. Okay, so what is Moz? It replaces methods. So we're going to replace constructors. Static ones, we will just wipe them out. Because when do they execute only once, and there's no guarantee when they're going to execute. So the story for static constructors, you can basically tell us to erase it. And we'll just remove it in Charlie. But instance constructors are more interesting. Okay, so the way you're going to do with constructors is you're going to rewrite a constructor. So if we have the stream reader constructor, which takes a string, you will see a static method in the mStream reader type that's called constructor, and then the same naming convention. So here it takes a string. Now, it's actually a delegate that takes a runtime instance of the stream reader, whatever you're constructing, and then the argument. Okay, that instance is very special. It's just freshly created by .NET, and no constructors has been run on it. So it's a lot of zeros, right?
And how you call the base method or something like this, you need to call it or this kind of stuff?
You don't. Once you start, it's possible. It gets tricky beyond this exercise.
Okay. But
yeah. The first thing you want to do is, okay, this is funny, instantiate a mole and pass it that runtime instance. Okay, so far we dealt with static methods, so we never have to instantiate. So I'm creating a stream reader and passing it this runtime instance. So what mole is going to guarantee you with that is to not allow any call to that runtime instance. Remember, this is only zeros. If you call a method on this, you'll get a null reference. So internally, PEX is going to track this, and if you try to call a method on this me instance, you'll get a null reference. So that's how you wipe out constructors. The next thing is how you deal with instance methods. There's two ways to deal with instance methods. One way is to look at is to replace the instance methods for all instances. In that case, you will see in all mole types, there is a nested type called old instances. So you can actually try it out, do mfile dots, or maybe mStreamReader dots. You'll see there's a nested type called old instances. And then it has static properties to replace instant methods for all instances. That's one way to do it, or this is a more fun way to do it. You can actually dispatch a delegate for that single instance. So I have this mole, I'm basically telling dispatch this delegate, so replace read to end by this delegate. In that case, we don't need the receiver, so it's not there. Confusing?
Yes.
Yeah, constructors are fun. So,
content. What is content?
Oh, content is
okay.
So the best way to understand this is try changing the implementation to using a stream reader. Write this and breakpoint here and run in the debugger and see what's happening. Conceptually, we're replacing a constructor. Might seem confusing, but so imagine what happens when you create object in .NET. .NET generates this, generates the memory necessary for the object, and then it calls your constructor. And we are right there in the middle. And that's how it works.
But that's a way to generate objects too.
Hmm?
I mean, you can make factories for compact objects. You can change the mold of the constructor so pets can easily create objects.
Okay, so good point. So this case is to deal with the case where you have a new in the method body, which is notoriously hard to test because you basically hard-coded the dependency there. When you need a fresh instance of stream reader, you can create the stream and stream reader without the argument. And we actually do the same as the runtime, create an uninitialized runtime instance internally. There is an API in the remoting services namespace that allows you to create a reference type without running the constructors. It's used for serialization. So we just use that. But let's try this example. So go ahead, refactor your code to use a stream reader. Change that. Just for fun, run the unit test. You'll see they'll all fail, because now the moles are don't match your implementation anymore. And then try doing the constructor version. I think, I mean, the message is write testable code at the first place. Then your life is easier. Here I'm replacing the implementation of read to end. This is replacing constructor, and then inside of it, hooking the instance method.
Could you do it outside of the
editor? Well, you could, but you instantiate this guy inside. You could actually define a local here. It gets tricky. Actually, all this, it gets really lazy. Everything is done nested. You have really deeply nested. And yeah, I encourage you to put a breakpoint right here and see what happens. And the typical mistake is to forget this guy. Make sure you pass the runtime instance to the constructor. My fault.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to try two. So if you're used to link and object creation syntax, you can actually use that syntax to write more concise Morse code. I know I shouldn't use new syntax, but sometimes I do. Working. So, César, yeah. This is what I was talking about. So,
cool.
It's getting there,
but that's not public yet.
No. It's not secret, but it's not ready.
Thank you.
X is confused. Oh, I should call the method on the test. That's why it's not generating anything. So what is the question? Yeah, that's why I don't get any test case. So with split, there's more cases because we now have multiple lines. In fact, we lost the foo case. Okay. Did you manage to go and the debugger and have fun with this guy? Okay, let's do that. Just so if you didn't get into the debugger, we can actually debug this little guy. So the constructor is kind of confusing. You know, this we're surprised it just worked out of the box when we built moles. So here I am in my detour, and if you look at the call stack, it totally makes sense. Generate a test, parameterize test, method on the test, the constructor of stream reader, and then our detour. So it fits into the idea of moles. It's just that me is null. Oops. Now if I look inside of me, well, everything is null because nothing has been run on it. And then you can put a then you can continue, and you get this delegate, it gets called, and now you're the read to end delegate. So I think, you know, you will be confused by moles. Use a debugger to figure out what's happening. You can actually step through things and see what is happening in there. But then conceptually, we're replacing methods with something else. It's interesting to say that although we changed one, you know, we did read all text, read all lines before, and now we do a read to end and a split. It's almost functionally the same, although I'm not calling split quite correctly. But with mock frameworks, you will always have a test failure here because you've changed the API you're calling. No matter how good your syntax is, it will break. The benefit when you're using PEX is that you can regenerate the test suite really quickly. Fix the parameterized test in one place and then fix the test suite. Let PEX regenerate. Guys, we still have 2 hours. If you're surviving. Okay. Do you have any more questions about this delegate business? So it is confusing and it's getting late, so I'm totally understanding that. So delegates, instance methods. To finish the loop about instance method, there was this question, how you instantiate objects. So for example, what if I took the stream reader Now I did just a colon. So what if I change implementation and now I need a stream reader, which I don't want to implement? It's kind of a bad example. The way you fix that is you instantiate a mol type and then you call dot instance on it. So dot instance returns you an uninitialized runtime instance of that particular type. See, it's a stream reader. So that's the way you can get any type but uninitialized. Okay? And we have an implicit cast, so you don't have to do that. And this works for sealed types too. So if you have a sealed type somewhere and you need an instance of that guy, you can do M, that sealed type, and just pass it into the API. There will be an implicit cast by C sharp, and then you just have this instance ready to go.
I changed the reader implementation just to use a stream reader and call the old extractor method that like parse 2 lines.
Yeah.
And text is only generating one test. And I don't know where I made my mistake.
Your hard cavity.
Yeah.
You only have one value. So text gonna change the value.
Okay, splitting was not a good idea. So this is another version where I needed a stream reader.
And basically that's the idea.
Okay, so I guess we can start doing an integrated exercise, although I think we've kind of covered it.
Let's see. Okay. So, actually, that's good. That's good. So here's the integrated exercise. You have the slides, so you can copy INI reader and try to test that guy. It has interesting things in it. There's definitely some little bugs in there, and so it tries to parse an INI file, so it has square brackets and then key value pairs. And it has, the parse INI is an instance method, so you will need to create this type. Do you want to go into this exercise? Do you want to take a break before we do this exercise? Or are you all hanging around pretty well? Or do you want to talk more about conceptual things? Or
I want, especially if you have something like this and you want to start using text to generate this, how will you start?
Okay, so it's an excellent question. How do you start? I think, okay, the question is, can you refactor? Question number one, are you allowed to refactor? If you can refactor, basically look at the areas where you have the most tabbing.
It's a good metric, whether your code is complicated. And this is inside of the while, there is a lot of logic. So this is where you want to focus your attention. Now the question is, how you get there? Right now, it's kind of hard to get there because I need a screen reader and everything. If I'm allowed to refactor, I can actually extract, it's using read line, it makes it tougher, but I could probably refactor what's inside of the using and work on a text reader. A text reader is something that is abstract. You can actually instantiate a text reader over a string, so you don't need a file there. Text will do it for you. So if you can do that, then you have the digger mode, then you can start writing assertions. Just kidding. But where to start is where your code is the most complex. In this case, it's really obvious. The constructor is almost empty. It's pointless. This is the bad guy. I would read the spec, which we don't have. What is this code supposed to do anymore? Does that answer your question?
More or less.
So if you run cyclomatic complexity, you'll see that this one has a much higher complexity than the constructor code. Tells you you should start testing things here. There is a little state machine in there, because there is this flag about intersection or not. And it has quite intricate semantics. How do you start testing in general?
Different test for it and way the problem must go, maybe like text is something like this, but maybe mentally.
Yes. And yeah, it's not obvious.
And it's a lot of test for its profile.
It's a lot of indexing. Okay, this might be a tough cookie so late in the day, but maybe we can do it together.
Which might be more fun. Okay. Let me go and copy this. Okay. So who wants to start? Maybe somebody can come in and come here in front. So if you try running PEX right there, you won't get a good result because you need a screen reader. And you didn't automatically set the moles. So you get exactly one test case. Now I see that what's inside using is interesting. So I can refactor that. And the trick is to use the base class now. So that PEX can actually generate a text reader that works on a string. Then it can start crunching. So I try to isolate the part that has a lot of complexity from the environment, and then I can just directly apply PEX. I'm very quickly to a point where I get value from running the tool. So the only thing I did was a refactoring and using text reader and making that the guide public. And then there's all kind of bugs in the system. And now it's a great time to start using code contracts to start fixing the bugs. For example, you might want to say that key is not null. And maybe that reader is not null. And then you can run PEX again. That takes care of a number of issues. And then there's more to it. I think beyond a certain point with this code, you'll want to start debugging because it's not clear what's happening here. You can look at the stack trace. I think here it's obvious. We get an empty line and we try to index into it. So maybe we make it, and you can just play around. So here it's just crash testing. It's not crashing anymore, but it's not clear it's doing anything interesting now. And that's where you could start writing maybe traditional unit test or parameterized unit test, and so forth. We executed 100 times the code and didn't find any new interesting code. So, yeah, I didn't show that, but when you want to increase boundaries, there's this button. But if you do that in Digger mode, it creates a whole new test project because I deleted the previous one. But in a sense, this is something I haven't shown yet. So you've run all this code in Digger mode. You can actually select all the tests and save them. And if needed, we'll create a new test project for you. Otherwise, we'll reuse an existing one, if you have one. It's actually 20 steps to create a full-blown test project when you think about adding references, internals, visible to, and all this stuff. So now there's a new test project with my test case, and I can actually write assertions if you want to. But now I can actually debug a test case. So I can go to one of those test cases and debug it. Okay, that wasn't a great test case. Okay, did I go too fast here? Maybe I went too fast. Okay. Yeah.
When PEX is not generating good values, is there a better way to help him? Help you? You know, I mean, is a matter of studying the specific case, or is some strategy to?
So the strategy would be to restrict the range of inputs by restricting how many inputs you give to PEX. And one way to restrict it, for example, in this case, is to, let's say, instead of having PEX generate an object, you create the object for PEX. It makes the search easier for PEX, less constraints. So whenever PEX doesn't give you good results, you can always restrict the degree of freedom, then expand back.
Sometimes the input is very sophisticated.
Yeah.
Like XML.
If you
should be quite hard, I think.
Yes. So actually, it's a good point. I skipped that for exercise.
I think that's what's happening in
I didn't talk about this, and I should have. So. Maybe I let people play on the INR reader, but we haven't talked about all the cases where PEX doesn't work, which is very interesting. So usually when this happens, you have this bar that shows up, and you need to take a look. The one we've seen before was the instrumenting code instrumentation, which we've dealt with, so that's all understood. I'm going to skip that. The other one is testability. So it's really related to MOLS. PEX instruments and analyzes .NET code only. That means anytime you leave the .NET world, like the file system, the database, or any C++ code in general, well, we don't understand the program, and then we just don't generate good constraint system. So this is a canonical example. If you have a program that starts by validating that the file exists or not, and for if it doesn't exist, PEX will never be able to make that true because it cannot change the file system. I think we don't have moles here. So that's typical of, if code depends on the environment, you run PEX blindly, you don't get good results. Because it will stop at this first line. You might have a million statements here. It will never pass through this check. The other thing is hidden complexity, which takes us into XML parsing. So, believe it or not, XML is quite a complicated format, and the parser is quite big. So when you try to take a string, pass it into an XML parser, like XML document, and try to parse something out of that, PEX will never scale to it, at least today. So, for example, here's an example that we got from a user, and it's quite interesting. So it takes an array of strings, computes a sum over it in a very inefficient way, and then complained that we couldn't figure out 1, 2, 3. So look at the loop. It has a string, parses the integer and the sum, sums it, and converts back to string. And does that in a loop. I can tell you this code is very slow first, and it's not really efficient. So, if you write absurdly inefficient code, then you will defeat a tool like PEX. That's as simple as that. There's no free lunch, especially when you're dealing with constraint systems. If you're not shocked by this code, you talk to me. We've seen there are some boundaries, so PEX will stop when it ran for too long, when it hit too many branches, when it hit too many calls, too many conditions, too many runs, solver timeout, and so forth. So there's a number of bounds to make sure it finishes, it terminates. Otherwise, PEX would run forever as soon as you have a loop. Okay, so actually, that's a fun example. I don't know who's still working on the INI parser. I'll leave you that as an exercise. Try writing this and running CodeDigger on it. Have you ever thought what happens in parsing a date time? Okay, I'm going to do it. Everybody's kind of tired, so do the demo. Let's go back to here. Parse time. Okay, so it seems quite innocent. You're just parsing a date time. But when you run PEX through this, the first time we're going to hit a lot of APIs we haven't instrumented. So you're not going to see a lot of test case, but we're going to see uninstrumented calls. So when you see that, go to this page. There's two method calls. Look whether they matter. You can look at the stack trace where they happened. And tell PEX to instrument those. Okay. And then you have to run again each time you do an update. And then we're going to dig a little bit deeper and hit more unknown APIs and do that in a loop until we kind of reach a fixed point. So there's more test case, but we're hitting a lot of code here. Yeah, parsing daytime is fun. Okay, so there's all this mysterious type. Let's go and do that. Okay, so we're starting to generate more test case. So most of the time we get format exception, which is fine. There's still those uninstrumented methods, but these ones are pointless because basically get platform always returns x86 or x64 and the version is not going to change. This one might be more interesting, or there's a lot of them. Is valid day might be very interesting. So let's stop the search. Instrument those guys too. And try again. And in a sense, this is the experience when you do a misquoted. In general, we instrument everything up front. It's not that bad. But daytime is kind of an important type, so we don't do it beforehand. Okay. Interestingly, this is a valid date. Whatever it means, valid. So, there's one thing I haven't shown today. In this case, format exception is actually an expected exception. When we send an invalid input, we get a format exception. So there's a way in PEX to filter those automatically. So what I'm going to do is click on format exception, and here click on allow exception. So allow exception is a looser form of expected exception. It is allowed to occur, but it doesn't have to. So now you can see there's a new little attribute here. So the next time PEX runs, no more. Let's write this. So the next time PEX runs, any format exception is going to be flagged as a passing test case. So we should have much more green. And it's going. So, daytime parsing is quite involved. It's a big chunk of code in the runtime. There's many, many formats. If you look at MSDN, it's big.
You don't go
still running. It's not happy about this guy. And its constraint solver is timing out all over the place. Eventually, we might hit our test case. So here you can see a little indicator that we've run 278 times. We had another passing date time. Very odd. Quite mysterious. And it's basically churning. So ultimately, PEX can leverage all your computational power forever to crack your code. So it's a great scenario for Nike builds where you want to let it go forever on your code.
Have you tried to do that?
We've done big experiments where we run PEX on 20, 30 cores on some libraries at Microsoft. Yeah, we found some interesting things.
Okay, so is there a chance to really find a very, very, very hidden book?
If you have assertions, yes. If you don't have assertions, it's a whole other problem. You don't get the interesting branches that find the interesting bugs. Right. And of course, you need something that is algorithmic. Typically, parsers are really hard to test. So just, let's see, for fun, oh, it stops. So I'm going to set it up here. I'm going to run this guy, and then there's one more funny view that we have. I think we're reaching the end. Let's see. So it didn't find the case. That's sad. There's a view that gives you so it's the dynamic coverage view. So this line is what's covered. This line is what's known. And every vertical line is a test case. And that's time. So that's time, that's coverage. Oops. And it's basically moving. It gives you a sense of, this is demoware, ready for demos. you know, it shows you the progress of PEX. In this case, now it's churning hard, deep in implementation of datetime now, and not giving anything interesting. Here on this button, you can see the boundaries that have been hit. So it has hit this boundary 200 tests, 100 tests without generating a new test case. So you want to maybe increment that guy to infinity and try again, and it will hit another boundary. So again, on your dev machine, you only have like 1 minute before you get really annoyed by the tool. But on your build machine, machines are cheap. You can let it run for a long time, especially if you know it's an area that has a lot of potential bugs, very complicated algorithms. So now it's churning. Here it's changing, it's improving. I guess we're kind of at the end of the class. I can answer any question, raise any challenge. Do you want to do something more? Are you totally washed out? It's been a long day. Very hot and very a lot of new stuff for you guys. Come on, let's find it. Eventually. it's because there's the movie recording, so I don't have all the power for the computation. Hopefully you get a clear idea of how you can start applying PECs in your code base. It's a new tool. So there's only so much documentation found out there. If you're trying to get started with PECs or in your team, and you're looking for the best way to get started, my machine is 100%. Make sure it's venting. We've actually done a lot of work documenting things. So if you go to our documentation page, you can see a list of tutorials in order of difficulty. Most of the things we've done today, you can do at home step by step. And you start with level 200, and you work your way through all the way to 500. Deep down there. So if you're, you know, probably you will forget 80% of what I told you today, maybe 90. If you want to get back and do the same again, most of the exercises we've done today are actually fully described and documented in those PDFs. So if you can get back and do it again. And this guy is still going. It might go for a long time. Talking about feedback, you can follow us on Facebook. You can ask questions on our forums. It's quite active. And you can play online. I think at this point I'm just going to take questions or challenges while this guy is crunching away.
One question. I would love that for when you were showing us how to use text from the command line, when we try to use this, is there any kind of I don't know, a contribution or something to be easier to use it in MS Build?
So there's no MS Build task. But it's a command line, so you just use exec. It returns non-zero exit code when something went wrong. The command line has, because we use it ourselves, has a lot of options. In fact, Visual Studio is launching the command line with some flags. So one of the interesting options is you can do the same targeted testing with the command line. So we have a concept of filters. So you can filter the test type by the type name or the method name. That means PECs will only run what's inside of that test type. So you can work from the command line.
When you do something like this, what you've shown right now, are you doing like these bigger tests?
That's actually running the mode in parameterized unit test. You can do the digger test, so you can do. Then there's this funny mode. Yeah, we could document that. So that will act. That will do digger.
So it's not documented. All the parameters only in the cell.
It is documented. we haven't really documented the fully automated version of PECs, but that will basically run the wizard. I think you can take a look at a project called AutoPECs on CodePECs, which does a diff between yesterday's build and today's build and runs PECs on those on the method that I've changed. It's a little open source extension to PECs. This does the digger, but from the command line. So if you do that, you will bound every API that you have in your code base.
it's like mark it as an error, then it will return something that is different from zero on the output.
So, yeah, that's, we have a flag for that. Hold on. So in terms of build automation, first you want to say, don't open the report. Then you want to say, fail on a test failure. So we should document this. But so by default, PEX is a test generator. It assumes it did a good job if it actually generated a failing test case. So it will not return a zero exit code there. But there's a flag to force that. Now, in this mode, PEX will generate a non-zero exit code when it generates a failing test case. So this is precisely the command line you need to do systematic attack of your API from your continuous build. Whenever you're bored with the command prompt, if you press Control C once, it will cancel and generate the report. The command line is quite rich because we use it a lot to develop PEX. Those reports have a lot of details into it. But they weren't really designed with any kind of UI guidelines. So we don't know if they're usable for anybody else than us. But maybe they are. So here's the table.
The code needs to be prepared for instrumentation, or it automatically?
It does it to a large extent. It uses heuristics. Now, what you want to do in your mode, I know where you're going to, is you reference with this other flag a test project where you have all the instrumentation settings, or maybe already existing parameterized unit test. PEX will run your parameterized unit test, and for any API that's not called by a parameterized unit test, it will generate new ones for you. So it's kind of, that's what Visual Studio does. This part about the automated execution of PEX still have to be flushed out and kind of make it nicer. I mean, you shouldn't remember four arcane command line flags to make it happen. But you can drill into
creating an MS build task with flags.
Yeah. I mean, it's a command line. Okay, it's running. Okay, this guy gave up with the timeout. Okay, let's see. And PEX is running here. It's 5 p.m., so I think I'm done for today, but I still have one more hour. Do you want to hear more stories about PEX? Do you have more questions in the moles area, or maybe what's your feedback on this? Do you think you're going to be able to apply this, or you don't know because you haven't done it yet? But
one question: you show moles like creating the code. Is there any way just to like in module that you mark only one method call or something like this? Is there a chance to use in moles?
Yeah, so
like creating only a small class dynamically because you need only some place.
It is possible. There's a sample about it. So let me show you. If you look for DEC, no, come on. Okay, so DEC is a small wrapper. Basically, you're looking for something like this. Very small.
Yeah.
Yes. So we don't want to ship that, at least for now. It's in the samples. It's basically something like this, very simple. So the mole API, which is typed, is built on an untyped API. So let's see. Here, I could write something like mole runtime set mole, and then it can take a delegate and then what you want to replace. So that's the untyped API you can build anything on top of.
So object receiver could be anything from the framework.
Object receiver could be null when you're trying to replace it. You're basically trying to put this there.
Yeah.
And if this guy is null, then we'll replace all methods here. If this guy is a runtime instance, we'll do method dispatch.
Sorry.
Okay, so you could do this is my delegate. It's null, and I want to replace datetime. So type of datetime dot get method. The problem is it's untyped, so you need to. Really not happy.
Maybe.
Okay. Maybe that's why we don't do it. Ah. Can do that, you need to be careful because you could send a delegate that has the wrong signature, different signature in what you're trying to replace. But basically, yeah, moles is basically a big code generator around this API. Yes. So, same idea. You, I guess you need system.configuration, and then, in a sense, I have time. And then you add the moles for it.
And did you support header version? Because the first time I tried moles.
Yeah, the previous version didn't work with configuration. We fixed that in 0.92. So I have mole configuration. Now I can do m configuration manager app setting gets. And this returns a string dictionary. do something like, is the syntax working? No. Doesn't like it.
But you need to put brackets or double.
Didn't like it. Name value collection. So now I can do okay, and this should just work. Yay! So it works now. Okay, since we have the time, let me show you what I mean by pushing people into using models. So, models, which we call behaviors. So if you go into the MOS framework, you'll see that there's a folder called behaviors. And we ship the sources, but we also have a little script that will actually unpack them and then build them for you. So, and then it's generating kind of stuff here. The code you see here to deal with the configuration file is probably code you're going to write over and over and over and over and over again in your test case. In a sense, what you're trying, you're replacing the state that lives in a file by a state that lives in memory. And it's always the same thing. So what we've done with behavior is to refactor that into well-structured little models. Okay, so what do I mean? I'm going to show you that as soon as my... we're going to use a configuration example. So it's pre-compiling the moles here. So what do I mean by that? In a sense... be clear, if you create your name value collection here and now it's just about returning it, right? Then basically you've modeled the app settings by an in-memory representation. You've totally replaced all the file loading stuff by just... So it's the simplest model of what the configuration does. It's just an in-memory store. Now, this is cool. So why can't I just refactor that into a method and always use that? So what I can do is maybe do and then move that guy here because I want to access this. Access this type, I'm going to return it. Okay, now in my test case, I can do and then and suddenly my test case are more readable. And I don't have to deal with the moles. In fact, I can do it in one place here and not have to do it again and again and again. In my test case, I'm just talking about state. So we can make it clear. This goes away. is a okay. So still a lot of typing. Okay, now here comes the magic. Maybe you always want to ensure before you call something in Configuration Manager that you actually isolate it. And PEX can do it automatically for you. Okay, this is not part of the traditional tutorial because it's quite new. Right. Okay, so what's going to happen? This is a lazy, this is a lazy initialization method. It will be called automatically the first whenever you try to call anything on Configuration Manager. So whenever you try to access the configuration file, before that we're going to run this method which is going to install the moles. That means in my PEX test case, automatically I'm not going to hit the configuration file but actually the in-memory version.
What is the class as a prepare method?
Which class?
Configuration Manager.
And this lives in the test project.
Okay.
Yeah. So, although I don't have any configuration file, I don't know if app settings works without configuration files. Anybody knows? You can see it still works. And if we go to the test case, you can see that PEX appended the prepare method. So you can get a library of methods that you use to isolate this from the environment and reuse that all over the place. So let's do that for the file problem. Okay, so for the file, what we want to do is model it by a dictionary. Okay, hang on. There's a new set of data structures that we've built for you guys. So you map you. It's still not nice. It's not perfect. Okay, so you have a dictionary of file to file, so file to content. And now, whenever you do, wrong project. Let's take this guy into project here. Okay, so you're just looking at what we've been working on for the last weeks. And there's no tutorial about this whatsoever. Okay, so we have a dictionary from a file to file name to content. And we want to model the file system like that. So single user file system. So for example, all this code that I have here can actually move it here. So whenever we do, so we want to catch the constructor that takes a string, for example. And now what we do is pass it the runtime here, and then we do files, file name. Right. And so currently the problem is that my file system is always empty, so I need a way to populate it automatically. Right? And this is where you so fix the code here. Okay, so I'm probably going too fast here. No matter. Okay, so here. Okay, so we've set our mole automatically, but the file system is always empty. Now, what we're going to say is it's a arcane attribute, it's not turned on by default. And basically, this gives the opportunity to create different file systems on demand. And as so, nowhere in my test case I'm telling what stream read that I'm going to read stream reader. That's, oh. I need to actually hook to stream reader. So I'm going to hit stream reader. Then I'm going to prepare that type. Then, ooh. Didn't work. Oh. What's happening? My demo. Demo gods are against me. That should work. Come on. Oh, I ran the... Okay, that's why we're not shipping the feature. Yeah, there we go. So, I'm actually creating... So this is the state of the dictionary, and I'm creating different states that... and you see the inputs that are there. So, this is a brutal... This is a way to actually... automatically go through code that has dependencies and nicely refactor what you consider as the file system. Now, the interesting thing is we can actually ship a model of the file system and give it to you. You don't have to be an expert to understand it. For example, going back to the configuration manager, yes? Anything you want.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, you can return different kinds of things depending on the value of the parameters, and depending on the parameters you pass to a stream reader, also to the stream reader, then you will return different things. It's like,
yeah, so
a special kind of file if the name is something, or return another file,
so
or another dictionary with different values.
This doesn't know. This basically models any file system ever.
Oh. Of course, not for Digger exploration, for all the parameters. To mock one file only. I want to return
yes.
This kind of things if we try to use.
So, what you want to do
is if I read one file, return something. If I read another file, then return something else. Otherwise, return whatever.
Okay, what you want to do is this. So you want to expose the dictionary there, right? need to do something more, something we need to fix later on. That's don't mind this. This is still internal development. Anyway, so now I can write this. What is it? File prepare files sets one. And then I think we should have. I can't remember the name now because I use this random name. Okay. And you're going to run your test case. Now, we set the entire state. Plex cannot choose anything. There will be one test case, which interestingly throws a null reference. Oh. Okay, so. So bottom line is, and this is very important, if you use the behavior approach, which we need to document, you have test cases that are, in a sense, much more clear. It's like arrange, disarrange business, arrange the state. Don't tell me which method I need to call. This is refactored away. I only care about saying, and it's you're really close to what you had in integration test. Oh, I write this file right there, but now you do it in memory. So you kind of have best of both worlds. You have a very readable, understandable test case, but also isolated. Yeah. And there's no more lambda madness, right? I mean, yeah, come on. So, and we have a framework to do that. So we actually have primitives to efficiently set state. So this is this new behave type. And we also have a bunch of pretty fine behave types. So I've compiled them, and they will be better integrated in the next version. So, you know, don't try to repro this at home. It will be hard. But it, there's, you know, this was built, and then now here, there's all those behaviors that exist. So they are pre-built, ready to go. And for example, we can use, what is interesting? What do I have? One of the fun one you have when you do a web development is a system.web. So anybody has done, you know, HTTP context current, it's a hard one. Yeah. So now you can do, so our behavior start with B, and I can say set current dot set request dot URL equals foobar. And basically I have it. Or I can start a request, and now set all kind of things on it. Under the hood, this is using moles to redirect everything, right? And URL is a URI, or it's a URI. So we strongly believe that moles is a nice low-level API to isolate, and then further going further, we'll want to push the behavior story. It's not ready, it's not documented enough to teach it.
So if you do something like this, then in your code you can run HTTP context and...
See if this guy builds. No. Something wrong happened.
You mean it put HTTP on the UAs?
No, because I shouldn't execute. Oh, you're right. We never reached that point. And we got it. We got there. Okay. But since the behaviors come with preparation methods, actually you don't need to do that. It should be able to actually automatically drill into the code and automatically replace HTTP context. Come on. Okay, it doesn't. Oh, yes, it does. Okay, the trouble here is parsing URIs, which is as complicated as parsing date times. Ultimately, at some point, Pex will get it, so maybe we have something easier. Identity? What is identity? Is that a request or a response? Oh, so we can actually so here it's interesting because this is an interface. So this is an interface and this is a concrete type. And the model can go through all that. Right? So this is not parameterized. And the idea is, as soon as you call current, we hook up. And then we start generating the state. And we are in control over what is in roles. Roles is an array of strings. And we generate things that's, you know. And then, of course, all the power of PEX kicks in. So what is it? Does it have a name? And then you get those tricky conditions, you know, combination of multiple things here. And PEX will go and analyze everything in combination and generate it. But in the future, all those pain points where it's well known what the isolation piece starts, we want to provide out-of-the-box experience where it just works. So PEX figured out you needed an admin that was called foo to get some weird behavior. And when you look at the test case, it calls this preparation method we ship. So that might be the positive note of the day. So we strongly believe this is a great way to do isolated tests. The benefit is
you need to add some reference to this.
I had to compile this. So it's using types from system web behaviors. So actually, if you go to our documentation page, which I lost, we have a special tutorial for SharePoint that uses the behaviors. And it hasn't been backported to the general .NET experience, but ultimately in the future we'd like that to be automated. So it's well known in ASP.NET that HTTP current is like a start point, and HTTP cache is also a start point. You can model cache very easily. You don't cache. Or you cache forever. Then it's a deterministic cache. Because cache is actually very, very complicated. The benefit of those guys is you, the expert, as a mock expert, you can write those and have your team leverage them. And your team doesn't need to be an expert.
Also, if you look at the test, you can see how it reaches the point where admin and team were valid. So the code that you need to write if you want to do it manually.
And it really gets near to the given I should have. So. So in this case, you know, I'm doing the whole. Ooh, I don't have the user. Oh, current. So I can do it manually also. Ooh. So this is the fun part. Roles is an array. I can set all values in that array at once. So this is a unit test. There's nothing fixed. This is basically a range. Act. Interestingly, you can also assert, because the model stores state. So in that case, I guess I don't change the model. We need to. I don't know how I can do that. And do you know anything mutable on the maybe response? But anyway, so I can run this. And when you look at this, this is fairly readable. And more importantly, it doesn't specify how are you going to implement this. How are you going to call the API? So there's two things that can happen. Either you call APIs that are in the model, and then everything works. Or you call APIs that are outside the model. You fix the model, and then you're good to go. Forever. A researcher will tell you yes, but I wrote them by hand. A researcher will tell you yes, you can automate that, but I wrote them all by hand. And we give you full source, you can learn from what I did that. So this guy passed. So it's a very restricted, isolated test, very readable. Somebody has to write the models. And once you have them, in a much better position to write very robust and readable test cases. It's a big segue. Maybe I can give you a SharePoint demo if you want to. Or kind of hang around. I don't want to, take your time, guys. So to drill more into this behavior, one thing, who's that SharePoint here? Wow, nobody. And maybe I don't do a SharePoint demo. Nobody's. I think we can finish. Okay. Thank you to camera, then I'm shutting down my camera.